Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. This is On Air Daily News for Thursday, April 6, 2023. I'm Naima Latif, and today we are joining the White House to get a response from President Biden
and without
regarding the students who are being threatened with expulsion for their decision to protest gun violence. Let's join the White House live for this presentation by White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre.
Welcome, Dan. All right, everybody. Happy Thursday. Good afternoon. I have a few things at the top before I turn it over to the Admiral. As I was walking out here today, we saw news that Republican legislators in Tennessee were preparing to vote on the expulsion of three Democratic officials who stood in solidarity with children and families peacefully protesting for action on gun safety. The fact that this vote is happening is shocking, undemocratic, and without precedent. Across Tennessee and across America, our kids are paying the price for the actions of Republican lawmakers who continue to refuse to take action on stronger gun laws. The president will continue to call on Congress to take action to ban assault weapons and high-capacity magazines, require safe storage of firearms, eliminate gun manufacturers' immunity from liability, and require background checks for all gun sales. And state officials must do the same. This has been one of the worst weeks of 2023 so far in terms of anti-LGBTQ bills becoming law in states across America. Three anti-LGBTQ laws have been enacted so far this week in Kansas, Indiana, and Idaho. Just yesterday, the North Dakota Senate passed 10 anti-LGBTQ bills in just one day, a single day record. In Kansas, the state legislation overrode Governor Kelly's veto to make Kansas the 20th state that has banned transgender kids from participating in schools sports. With the enactment of a new law in Indiana, 14 states have now banned gender-affirming health care, while some of these laws are currently blocked by courts. This is a dangerous attack on the rights of parents to make the best health care decisions for their own kids. According to the Human Rights Campaign, more than 50% of transgender youth in the U.S., which is estimated to be more than 150,000 kids, live in states in which transgender youth have lost access to or at risk of losing access to gender-affirming care. Look, this is awful news. We'll be very clear about that. LGBTQI+ kids are resilient. They are fierce. They fight back. They're not going anywhere. And we have their back. This administration has their back. We are so proud of the kids across this country who have organized protests and school walkouts to tell the politicians in their states to stop this legislative. I know that these political attacks can really take toll on people's mental health. So I want to say directly to LGBTQI+ kids, you are loved just as you are, just the way you are. And if you're feeling overwhelmed, you call 988, the National Crisis Hotline, and dial the number 3 to talk to a counselor who has been specifically trained to support LGBTQI+ kids. This is a new service that the Biden administration is proud to offer during these incredibly hard times for these trans kids. Now, one last thing before we move on to the briefing on Sunday. Okay, so the in-town pool has to gather for the president's departure. And we'll just continue. So if you all want to go ahead and do that, feel free, and then we'll still continue with the briefing. So we can go quickly here, I want to give you guys a week ahead as we normally do on Fridays. On Sunday, the president and the first lady. Let's do this quietly, friends. Thank you. On Sunday, the President and the First Lady will return to the White House from Camp David. On Monday, the President and the First Lady will host the 2023 White House Easter Egg Roll, a tradition dating back to 1878. A teacher for more than 30 years, First Lady Jill Biden is continuing her theme of education for the event, transforming the South Lawn and the Ellipse into a school community full of fun educational activities for children of all ages to enjoy. In addition, the time-honored traditions of rolling and hunting eggs, this year's White House Easter Egg Education Roll will also feature a schoolhouse activity area, reading nook, talent show, field trip to the farm, picture day, a physical education zone, a snack time tent, and more. On Tuesday through Friday, the President will travel to the United Kingdom and Ireland. The President will first travel to Belfast, Northern Ireland, from April 11th through April 12th to mark the tremendous progress since the signing of the Belfast Good Friday Agreement 25 years ago, and to underscore the readiness of the United States to support Northern Ireland's vast economic potential to the benefit of all communities. The President will then travel to Ireland from April 12th through April 14th. He will discuss our close cooperation on the full range of shared global challenges. He will also hold various engagements, including in Dublin, County Louth, and County Mayo, where he will deliver an address to celebrate the deep historic ties that link our countries and people. On Monday, we'll have some more to share about the details of that trip. Now, finally, as many of you know, over the past many months, departments and agencies key to the Afghanistan withdrawal have been conducting thorough internal after-action reviews, examining their decision-making process and execution. Those reviews fed into a process looking across the administration, and today the NSC will also be releasing a document that provides our perspectives, outlines in broad strokes some of what we learned and how we have already implemented those lessons in other global challenges. My colleague, Admiral John Kirby, is here today to discuss that document and we with all of you today and answer your questions. And with that, Admiral, the floor is yours.
Nearby. So I want to start today by, again, updating you, as Corrine said, on the administration's work to assess the withdrawal from Afghanistan. As you all know, over these many months, departments and agencies key to the withdrawal conducted thorough internal after-action reviews, each of them examining their decision-making processes, as well as how those decisions were executed. Today, they are making those reviews available to relevant committees in the Senate and the House, as previewed by Secretaries Blinken and Austin in testimony last month. Those reviews, as Corrine said rightly, fed into a process looking across the administration. So today, we are also making available to all of you and to the public a document that provides our perspectives on the withdrawal and outlines in broad strokes some of what we learned, as well as how we are already implementing some of those lessons. That document will be posted to the White House website at the conclusion of my briefing. But I'd like to take some time, if you'll allow me, to provide you an overview. First, and most critically, the President's decision to end the war in Afghanistan was the right one. The United States had long ago accomplished its mission to remove from the battlefield the terrorists who attacked us on 9/11 and to degrade the terrorist threat to the United States from Afghanistan. And now, with that war over, we can more squarely address the most pressing challenges of our day. America is on a stronger strategic footing, more capable to support Ukraine and to meet our security commitments around the world, as well as the competition with China, because it is not fighting a ground war in Afghanistan. Of course, we continue to address terrorist threats, which, as the President accurately assessed, had migrated to other parts of the world through effective over-the-horizon operations, including those that took out the leaders of al-Qaeda and ISIS, al-Zawahiri and Haji Abdullah, respectively. But while it was always the President's intent to end that war, it is also undeniable that decisions made and the lack of planning done by the previous administration significantly limited options available to him. President Biden inherited a force presence in Afghanistan of some 2,500 troops, the lowest since 2001. He inherited a special immigrant visa program that had been starved of resources, and he inherited a deal struck between the previous administration and the Taliban that called for the complete removal of all U.S. troops by May of 2021, or else the Taliban, which had stopped its attacks while the deal was in place, would go back to war against the United States. The President's transition team asked to see plans for that removal. They asked to see plans for a security transition to the Afghan government and they asked if he plans to increase the processing of special immigrant visas. None were forthcoming. Transitions matter. That's the first lesson learned here. And the incoming administration wasn't afforded much of one. Thus, President Biden's choice was stark. Either withdraw all our forces or resume fighting with the Taliban. He chose the former. But even in so doing, secured extra time to conduct that withdrawal, stretching it out to August. And that's the second point worth making. Despite having his options curtailed, President Biden led a deliberate, rigorous, and inclusive decision-making process that was responsive to facts on the ground. He focused keenly on the need for proper planning. In fact, President Biden directed his top national security leaders to begin planning for a withdrawal even before he had made the final decision to leave Afghanistan. He ordered troop reduction plans, plans to turn over bases and equipment to the Afghan government, as the previous administration had negotiated, plans to draw down our diplomatic presence, and plans to evacuate both American citizens and Afghan allies alike. Indeed, evacuation planning started in spring of 2021, and the president ordered additional military forces pre-positioned in the region by mid-summer in case they were ever needed. Throughout, President Biden insisted that his team plan for worst-case scenarios, such as the fall of Kabul, even though the intelligence community's assessment when he was making the decision in early 2021 was that Taliban advances would accelerate only after the withdrawal of U.S. forces. The president repeatedly requested assessments of the trajectory of the conflict from his military and his intelligence professionals. No agency predicted a Taliban takeover in 9 days. No agency predicted the rapid fleeing of President Ghani, who had indicated to us his intent to remain in Afghanistan up until he departed on the 15th of August. And no agency predicted that more than 300,000 trained and equipped Afghan National Security and Defense Forces would fail to fight for their country, especially after 20 years of American support. In fact, the assessment was that the promotion of Acting Defense Minister Bismillah Khan Mohammadi would actually strengthen their resolve to stay and fight. And so, another lesson learned was the need to plan early and extensively for low probability, high risk scenarios. I should note here that our experiences in Afghanistan informed our decision to set up a small group of experts for worst case scenario planning on Ukraine, which included simulation exercises and our ability to forcefully and plainly speak publicly about the risks we saw of a pending invasion. Now look, there's always going to be tension between highlighting warning signs that a country may collapse and undermining that same government. And that's a difficult balance to strike. But in Ukraine, and before that in Ethiopia for that matter, we prioritized earlier drawdowns of our personnel when each of those capitals were under threat. Months before Russia's invasion, we released intelligence with trusted partners, and our warnings about the invasion grew louder and more public. This aggressive approach allowed us to organize with our allies and help enable Americans in Ukraine to depart safely. And just to remind, we continue to facilitate the safe departures of Americans from Afghanistan when they tell us they are ready to leave. And we have proudly welcomed nearly 100,000 of our Afghan partners and their family members to the United States. Many of these families left Afghanistan after the withdrawal, and they continue to arrive on a regular basis. Now, I'd be remiss here if I did not also express our gratitude to the many private and nonprofit groups, including those comprising veterans of the war, who helped us identify, contact, and arrange for the safe transport of thousands of these brave Afghans. Without their help, or the incredible assistance we received from countries in Europe and the Middle East that allowed us to use their facilities as way stations, we could not have moved as many people as quickly as we did. And that's yet another lesson that we learned, this one about the power of allies, partners, and friends. Now, we know we need more help, which is why we urge Congress to assist us in improving the special immigrant visa program and by passing the Afghan Adjustment Act, both of which will make it easier for us to keep meeting our commitments to our Afghan allies. No comments, none, about this withdrawal would be complete without mention of the deadly attack on the Abbey Gate on Karzai International Airport on the 26th of August. The president at the time made it clear to operational commanders that force protection remained his highest priority. In those 10 days, when the threat was particularly high, he accepted the recommendation of his national security team to extend the timeline for evacuations only after his senior military officials confirmed that they had sufficient resources and authorities to mitigate threats, including those threats posed by ISIS-K. He trusted the best judgment of his leaders on the ground to make all operational decisions, including with regard Fatty Gate. The President and the First Lady will always honor the sacrifices of the 13 service members who were killed in that attack, and we will never forget their families. We will mourn with them, remember with them, and support those Gold Star families. We mourn as well the loss of those Afghans killed by that suicide bomber on that day and others who lost their lives during the withdrawal. And we will also honor the bravery and selflessness of every member of the military, the Foreign Service, the intelligence community, and our civil service who made possible the largest airlift evacuation in military history, and all under the constant threat of attack. The effort was certainly not without days of pain, hardship, or bloodshed, but neither was it without courage or poise or professionalism. For all the lessons that we take away, we should remember that over 20 years of war, and in its final days, these men and women saw things and did things and carried things with them that you and I will never fathom. We must make sure that they and their families know that their service mattered. We must make sure they get the help and the support that they need. We must make sure that their legacy is never forgotten. They ended our nation's longest war. That was never going to be an easy thing to do. And as the President himself has said, it was never going to be low grade or low risk or low cost. We should be humble enough to let that also be a key lesson learned from Afghanistan. Thank you. I'll take some questions.
So, John, thank you for doing this, but I think I speak on behalf of my colleagues in this room, and we want the record to reflect that this was sent to us about 10 minutes before the briefing began. Little notice. It's the very definition of a modern major holiday news. It's the beginning of the high holidays, and after months of requests from Republicans and the broader public. So why today? And is this all we get? And is this a response to the studies that were done by the agencies? Or is this considered a summary?
There's a lot there. This is the result of months and months of work by individual agencies who were participating in the withdrawal to voluntarily review that withdrawal, which they did. They worked through that. These documents are classified. And we felt it was the responsible thing to do after those reviews were done to then run a process across the administration to take a look at those reviews ourselves, across the interagency, work our way through it, and then provide them to the relevant committees and leaders on the Hill, which we did today. We think that was the responsible thing to do. And what you're seeing today is the result and the culmination of an awful lot of work, Ed. No effort here to try to obfuscate or try to bury something. It's an effort to try to be as open, as transparent as we can be. And what you got in that document there is a pretty fair summary of our perspective of the work over those many months and pulling and collating a lot of those lessons learned together. And we're trying to present certainly the key lessons learned, the ones that that we're able to share more openly and more publicly with you. And I'll tell you this, you got questions after the briefing today, I'll stay here as long as you want. You got questions after the briefing today, you know how to get a hold of me, we'll answer whatever you have.
I got two specific ones about what's in this document after speed read here. On page 8, the President received and accepted the unanimous advice of his top national security officials to end the evacuation on August 31st. What is the definition of a top national security official? Because we know, for example, that General McKenzie, who was then head of CENTCOM, has said he objected to aspects of this. So what's the definition of a top national security official?
I am loath to get into the individual advice that individual members of the President's team give him. That would not be appropriate for me, but I can tell you, having lived through this as well at the Pentagon, that the President specifically asked his team, should we extend past the 31st? He specifically asked them to go back and look and see what that would look like, because we had secured this additional time from the Taliban to the 31st of August. And the team did that. The team did that, Ed, not just at the highest levels of the Pentagon, the Secretary to the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, to General McKenzie, but even the operational commanders on the ground. And there were numerous flag and general officers on the ground at the airport. All of them took a fair look at the President's request and came back to him and said that it would not be advisable, given the high threat environment. Remember what also happened on the 26th, that attack at Abbey Gate? And then we had a very high temp between the 26th and the 30th, in which, of course, there was a kinetic strike taken in downtown Kabul. There was high temp. And so the advice of his senior national security team all the way up to the senior levels of the Pentagon advised him that the 31st was the appropriate date to end that evacuation.
There's four pages here of blame on the previous administration or this White House explanation of what the last White House did regarding Afghanistan. Nowhere in here does there appear to be any expression of accountability or mistake by either the president himself or others. Is there any for what happened?
I would argue that the very fact that we voluntarily, the agencies voluntarily decided to go conduct after-action reviews. Nobody told them to do that. That wasn't legislated by Congress. They did that on their own. And the fact that they did that and that we were now placing it on the Hill for Congress to look at, the fact that we digested and distilled some of the key points of that and gave it out in a public document, the fact that I'm up here talking to you about it, I think shows you how seriously the president felt about learning lessons from this withdrawal. I would also point out to you that the work isn't over. So, number one, even before you got that document, some of those lessons were applied. I talked about Ethiopia. I talked about Ukraine. And number two, it's not like the work is all over. The president signed the legislation enabling the Afghan War Commission to be formed, and we're going to continue to work and cooperate with that. That's going to look at the whole 20 years. America's longest war deserves a lengthy review and lengthy study, and the president's committed to that.
Thank you. In reading this, you seem to be conceding that evacuation should have happened sooner and faster, saying we now prioritize earlier evacuation, noting that today you would message evacuation more aggressively. I understand you've made clear the president does not have any regrets about his decision to withdraw, but in hindsight, in reading this, does the president have any regrets about how this withdrawal was carried out?
The president is very proud of the manner in which the men and women of the military, the Foreign Service, the intelligence community, I went on and on and on, conducted this withdrawal. But look, I've been around operations my entire life, and there's not a single one that ever goes perfectly according to plan. Things happen. Sometimes enemies get a vote, and you always want to learn from that. And one of the things that we learned, and I talked about it here in my opening statement as well, is that that balance of striking. When do you pull out when a government is under threat, particularly a friendly government, and do so in a way that doesn't undermine the very government you're trying to support? That's a tough balance to strike, and it's different in every single case. And as I said, we learned from Afghanistan, and we applied that lesson in Ukraine and Ethiopia, that being aggressive in the information space and being willing to move a little sooner may be the best thing.
But does he wish he had done things differently?
The president, I think everything is laid out here in this document about the main takeaways, the main lessons that we learned. Again, the president's enormously proud of the men and women who conducted this withdrawal.
And just one last thing. On the last page here, you note that the speed and ease with which the Taliban took control of Afghanistan suggests that there was no scenario except a permanent and significantly expanded U.S. military presence that would have changed the trajectory. I wonder, what is your message to the veterans, to the families of the fallen, who may read that and wonder, what was the point?
The president said many times that the mission that we originally were sent in to Afghanistan for was accomplished a long, long time ago. Remember, they were ordered in under President Bush to avenge the 9/11 attacks and to go specifically after Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda. And decimating and degrading al-Qaeda's capability in Afghanistan was a mission that we accomplished a long, long time ago. And over time, the president has talked about this, the mission in Afghanistan morphed into something it wasn't intended to originally be. That doesn't, just because the mission changed over time under previous administrations and leadership and scenarios, doesn't mean that anybody who served in Afghanistan doesn't have something to be proud of, doesn't have service to this country that they can take with them the rest of their lives and feel honorable about it. They didn't make those decisions. They signed up. They raised their right hand, all volunteers at a time of war, to say, yeah, put me in. I'm going to go fight. And some of them didn't make it back. And everybody that made it back a little bit different than when they left. And the president and the first lady understand that and respect that. And they should know that they will always have the commitment of the commander-in-chief and the respect of the country for doing that.
Thanks, great. The report says the Trump administration's 4 years of neglect, including deliberate degradation of Afghanistan operations in this year. Could you be specific about deliberate degradation? What are you specifically referring to?
There are many aspects. If you look at the Doha Agreement and what led up to that, when President Trump took office, there was more than 10,000 American troops in Afghanistan. He took it down to 2,500. He negotiated the release of 5,000 Taliban prisoners that were being held by the Ghani government without consultation with the Ghani government. He negotiated the Doha agreement with the Taliban without the Ghani government in the room. And he all but froze the special immigrant visa program, which had been providing opportunities for some of our Afghan allies to get out of the country and to come back. So it was a general sense of degradation and neglect there that the president inherited. And do not underestimate the effect that Doha agreement had on the morale, the willingness to fight on the Afghan National Security and Defense Forces. It had a very corrosive effect on their willingness to continue to fight for their country. Now, we didn't see that. We didn't see that. And part of the reason we didn't see that is because we couldn't see the plans that the previous administration allegedly worked on during the transition. No, as I said in my opening statement, none of those plans were forthcoming.
Except that the points that you just listed, especially, were the ones that made the transition.
Those were some of the key ones.
And a quick follow-up on what the report says about the administration not broadcasting loudly about any potential worst-case scenarios out of concern it would signal lack of confidence in the Afghan government's position. We obviously ended up seeing Ghani flee the country.
Yeah.
And so was that a well-thought-out decision?
What was a well-thought-out decision? His decision to flee?
Not broadcasting loudly any concerns about the lack of confidence in the Afghan government.
Yeah, I think, as I said, it's a different... It's a difficult balance to strike, and we were having internal conversations. In fact, we had conversations with the Ghani government about our concerns over what was happening in the countryside throughout Afghanistan there in early August. And where we came down on was not calling for an evacuation sooner because we didn't want the Ghani government to collapse. And we had every assurance made by President Ghani that he wasn't going anywhere, that he was still in charge, that he still had a viable administration. And so, you know, when do you make that call? And it's difficult. It's tough to do it in the moment. And nobody can predict the future. Again, as I said, we learned from that experience, and we applied a more aggressive approach, if you will, in Ethiopia and in Ukraine. But every instance is different. Every capital that's under threat is under a different kind of threat, and you have to evaluate.
That summer before the withdrawal, there was a defense channel cable that was written by 23 State Department officials there at the Kabul embassy, warning that the administration, in their view, was not prepared at that moment for the withdrawal. I'm curious, did this review take that defense cable into account?
You have to talk to the State Department. The State Department conducted an after-action review that, and so did DOD, and that's a question better put to them.
Specifically, then, for the president and this administration, I'm curious if there was a moment during the Afghanistan withdrawal that the president lost confidence in the assessments that were given to him by the intelligence community and lost confidence in the intelligence community, so, given that they failed to foresee how quickly the Taliban would have been
across the administration to try to give him the best information. It didn't stop him from asking throughout the entire withdrawal. He was constantly pulsing the national security team about this or that assessment and constantly challenging the thinking, constantly looking for ways to better understand what was going on the ground. Some of the assessments that was produced, as I put in my opening statement, were proved out to be not correct. But this was, you know, an honest effort by everybody to try to get at the right outcome.
And that was today's briefing, live from the White House. You've been listening to On Air Daily News. I'm Naima Latif, and we'll continue to bring you updates on local, national, and international news as it affects our daily lives. You can hear each news report in our archives at www.blogtalkradio.com/onairdailynews. Or go to www.onaireverywhere.com/radio network. I'm Naima Latif, Until tomorrow, enjoy the rest of your day.